after the elections, looking at the landscape for the next 2 years. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It's great to be here with you on this cold day in mid-November. Barry, I'm just, while we were prepping for this show, I was looking over some of the pictures that came in from, for instance, Buffalo and Cleveland and a lot of the places where cold air mass, very cold air mass meets warm, warm water or still warm water by comparison. And what do you get? Well, you get upwards more than 6 feet of snow and more on the way. And so far, I believe I heard in Buffalo there are 6 people dead from various parts of this rapid onslaught of snow. And it's not like they're not used to this in Buffalo, but my gosh, it's mid-November.
Charles, I know you might find this a little surprising because you're a little bit older than I am, but I remember when we had 5 and 6 feet of snow in mid-November.
Oh, I can remember. I can remember, usually, though, when I was a kid, we'd see the first snow flurries, usually around the 20th of November, knowing full well that, it was a pretty good possibility that by mid-December we'd have snow on the ground.
Right, and it seems like a lot of people are out there wringing their hands right now about this whole thing, you know, whether you want to call it global warming or climate change or, you know, the impending implosion of the sun and the destruction of our universe. Oh, wait a minute, I think I'm getting a little bit beyond it here. But the point is, Charles, all we're doing is getting back into a regular cycle. Folks, I'm in my mid to upper 40s. I remember when I was a kid, winters that were below zero, not wind chills, daily temperatures below zero, 5 and 6 foot snow drifts. I remember the roof of the place that we lived in when I was a kid. They had to get up on the roof with shovels to get the snow off before it collapsed. Because, and this was not January, February. This was November, December.
Well, that's when the really heavy snowfalls are. When I say heavy, I mean weighty because they're wet. This wasn't wet, though, this year.
Not
very wet.
No, but so, you know, we're kind of getting back to what I consider to be normal life because I think all of these really warm temperatures going all the way into late December and not really having a good cold snap. I mean, we've seen what happens when that happens. We've had increases in insect infestations. Yeah. Oftentimes what will happen is because it stays warm, the fruit trees don't hibernate as deeply or as early. And so then when the real frost comes, it kills them off. I know my orchards have taken a hit the last few years.
Well, okay, just a little bit on my background. I did wine and grape research in the small fruits department at Michigan State University. And one of the big important things in wine and grape research, especially since a lot of the grapes are kind of on the borderline as to whether they have a lot of winter survivability or not. Wine grapes especially. Table grapes, not so much. But we were doing things where we would take, doing research where we would take grapevines and measure how far down you could go before the bud actually died. And we had a freezer that would go down to like minus 75 degrees or something Fahrenheit. And it was interesting to watch that kind of stuff because that is what happens. But what happens is that's called cold hardiness.
Yes.
And cold hardiness is dependent upon how cold it actually gets. When it doesn't get that cold, the buds don't build the cold hardiness that they need to survive the winter.
Right.
Because what happens in the spring, they bud early and then another killing frost or freeze comes along and voila, your primary buds are all dead, which kills off your crop.
Right.
That's been happening a lot, and it's not happening the last couple years.
Well, just so folks aren't confused that they've tuned into Ohio Agriculture Hour,
we're just
waxing poetic on various issues. But, you know, Chuck, you mentioned that the combination that created all of this adverse condition out there was a cold air mass over warm water.
Yep.
Okay. Well, what happens when you get a warm air mass over cold water?
Fog.
Right, fog. And there's nothing more warm air mass than Congress. And so we are seeing already a fog is descending upon the newly minted Republican majority in Congress. You wondered how I was going to tie that together.
I wondered how you're going to do that. Good job.
But the fog is in the leadership because, folks, you know, the elections happened a couple of weeks ago. Everybody went and dutifully, you know, well, I shouldn't say everybody. It was the lowest voter turnout in Ohio in 64 years for a general election, a statewide general election. So a handful of us went out and voted our consciences or voted the party line or whatever we voted. And what we got was a change, especially at the federal level, as the United States Senate switched hands to the Republican Party. And that was reconfirmed with the concession in the state of Alaska, giving Republican challenger Dan Sullivan the U.S. Senate seat from Alaska. And it looks like with yesterday's vote down of the Keystone Pipeline, that Senator Mary Landrieu is probably not going to win the runoff in Louisiana because that was a key issue that she was trying to get some cover for in order to try to keep her seat. So
that's going
to
give the Republicans a 54 to 46 edge in the Senate.
It is. It's going to give them a significant edge. Now, they immediately went, and Mitch McConnell has become the Senate majority, well, incoming majority leader. Harry Reid's still the majority leader until the end of this congressional session,
right,
which is next month. So a lot of things can and probably won't happen in that length of time. There will be a lot of posturing and a lot of, well, we'll put this off until we can have control of it, which is what we heard after the vote on the Keystone Pipeline is they'll bring it back up, but they're not going to bring it back up this year. They're going to wait until McConnell and company have control of the Senate. Then they'll bring up the vote extension of Keystone.
The bills have to be rebuilt because at the end of a session like that, basically the bills
all die if they haven't passed through both chambers,
because
they have to start all over again.
Okay, here's how the Congress numbering system works. Every 2 years, you get a new Congress number. In other words, what are we on, the 115th or 16th, something like that?
Yeah, something of that nature.
So every 2 years, your Congress number changes, and when your numbers change, that means any bill that was pending when the number changes is dead. You basically start at HB1, and usually that's safe for the budget. Normally, I think they do HB1.
Well, it depends.
HJR.
At the state level. At the federal level, it's an entirely different ball game. They still start renumbering them from lower numbers, but it's really, it just depends on who gets there first.
Exactly.
It really does. Okay, well, this is the 113th Congress, so next year is the 114th.
That's about right, because we're at around 225.
Right.
225 this year.
Right, yeah, exactly. So basically, what we're going to be looking at next year is the 114th Congress. Mitch McConnell will have control now in the House. Obviously, the House had a great election. Picked up a lot of seats. And so now they're coming in with a significantly strengthened majority and have reelected John Boehner as the Speaker of the House. But there have been other important elections that have been happening over the last few days, Charles. Now, we're recording this, you know, the Wednesday before Saturday. So, you know, folks, this just happened like yesterday. Where there were votes on members of various committees. Now, the one committee that folks in Ohio were paying some attention to was the Government Oversight Committee. Now, that's the committee where Lois Lerner and the IRS have been, you know, and the targeting of conservative groups have been put under the grill. That's the committee where you're probably going to end up finding out whether or not people were responsible for Benghazi and things of that nature. The House Government Oversight Committee is become, well, let's just put the phrase that everybody likes to use, sexy. It's the sexy committee to be on because it's getting lots of TV airtime. And the chairman of that committee, Daryl Issa, who's a congressman, is stepping down because, you know, based on the federal House rules, they swap the chairmanships after a time in order to give more members the opportunity to have chairmanships and to build up, you know, experience. That's great. Well, this left an opening, and Ohio's own Congressman Jim Jordan from the Urbana area was one of the names that came out early for the potential new chairmanship of the House Government Oversight Committee. There were a couple of other members who were vying for it. One was Jason Chaffetz, who's also considered to be fairly conservative out of the state of Utah. And then a third member, I think, from Michigan. I don't know if it was Justin Amash or who it might have been.
My guess is he would not be considered for a leadership position.
He would not
position.
Be considered for a leadership position, most likely not. But what it really got down to was they had a vote yesterday, and Jason Chaffetz from Utah became the new chairman of the Government Oversight Committee in the House. Now, I think a lot of people are disappointed because Jim Jordan has really been putting himself out there and really pressing the point against people like Lois Lerner and others on this IRS scandal. But really, the committee chairmanships, they let the members vote on them, but leadership weighs in on that. And I think they were looking for someone who might have been considered a little bit more loyal to Speaker Boehner. Now, that's not saying that Jim Jordan is disloyal, but he has gone against the Speaker on a number of issues, and this may be the reason why he's now sitting there still as a member of the panel and not the chairman of the panel.
Well, as always happens, the there are chosen candidates, and there are candidates who run on their own behalf. You can see that the parallel of that in any election process. The central committee will come out and say, "Here's your slate." Well, those aren't the only guys running.
That's right.
And very often, the guys who are running off the slate of chosen candidates in any given party are very often the better candidates, but the candidates who are on the slate are willing to toe the company mark, and therefore they get the nod. And the same thing happens, I think, in the House of Representatives. Basically, the Speaker comes out and says, the Speaker wouldn't do it, but the whip probably would do this, would come out and say, "This is our slate. This is the guys who we want."
Sure,
to,
absolutely.
And they know what the votes are generally going in. They knew that Boehner was going to be reelected Speaker, despite the hue and cry from the rank and file.
Right. Well, the rank and file actually don't have a vote. That's
no,
the
rank and file don't have a vote.
Yeah, it's the members, and usually the Speaker and the Republican congressional campaign committees who've put in lots of money into their races usually have more pull than the electorate on that particular issue. And so that's usually what happens there. Now, again, this was pretty hotly contested. I mean, Jim Jordan was given it a very big push on this. But the House Republican Steering Committee basically are the ones who pick the chairman of the committees, you know. They all come before it, but that group, the steering committee, which is leadership plus a few hand-picked others, are the ones who picked the chairman. And so Jason Chaffetz was the choice there, probably considered to be a choice that would appeal to conservatives, but also would appeal to the rank and file as well, as they don't see him nearly as incendiary as Congressman Jordan has been. Now, God bless Jim. I love him, and I think he's doing a great job, and I think he should do more of it. It would have been nice to see him be the chair of the committee, because I think a lot of people were thinking that a lot of things would happen under him that may or may not happen under Jason Chaffetz. But looking at this House Steering Committee, okay, these were some of the other picks that they made. Now, most of these are probably not surprising. Paul Ryan from Wisconsin is now chairing the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah, I know I'm shocked that Paul Ryan's in leadership.
Yeah, well, of course not. You know, and again, that's not a surprise. They picked Rob Bishop from Utah to head Natural Resources. So that's two Utah congressmen who now chair committees. So that gets you to thinking about, okay, what's important about Utah these days? Tom Price of Georgia becomes the chairman of the Budget Committee. And then Mac Thornberry, who is a Texas Republican congressman, is leading the Armed Services Committee. So those are the other folks that... Oh, there, and I've got the list of the folks who were running for the House Government Oversight Committee. It was Chaffetz, Jim Jordan... excuse me for a second because my computer just decided to...
It's Representative Michael Turner.
Michael Turner from Ohio.
And John Micah from Florida.
Micah from Florida, that's right. I apologize because my computer just decided to wig out on me.
We're having a lot of that problem, folks.
I'm closing this one tab out because it seems to... Politico is a horrible site for trying to get
it done. I have two or three sites that I go to, and the Flash... The overuse of Flash on those program on those particular websites crashes my computer, and I have a relatively fast modern computer, and it even crashes my super fast business computer when I'm using it. So don't feel bad, Barry.
Well, that's okay. We'll cut most of that out anyway. But I'm having trouble just getting over to my tab because now my computer has locked up. Okay, well, anyhow, so these four were running, and Michael Turner, honestly, I believe, was in there just to siphon votes from Jim Jordan because if any of you are students of politics, you understand that a little interesting thing happened here right after redistricting in 2010 because Ohio lost a congressional seat. Actually, we lost two. And so they had to like reshuffle districts, and the original game plan was that they were going to put Michael Turner in the same district as Jim Jordan in order to force them to run against each other in a primary, because Turner is liked better by Speaker Boehner than Jordan is. What really happened, though, Chuck, was that Jim Jordan had enough support, ground support, that they realized they probably couldn't knock him off in a primary, especially with Mike Turner. So what they did was they wrapped Mike Turner's district into a district that was headed up by Steve Austria of Beaver Creek. And Austria did the smart thing and stepped out. And so he ended his congressional career in order to keep from facing Mike Turner, who was being backed by Speaker Boehner. So it's interesting that Mike Turner all of a sudden pops up as wanting the chairmanship of the House Government Oversight Committee, especially when they knew Jim Jordan was going to be running for it.
As badly disliked as Boehner is, it's hard to imagine that anyone would, and I'll be quite honest, nobody likes John Boehner, except Republican mainstreamers.
True.
Why they're so afraid of him, except that the Republican House committee that raises the money to get these guys elected was willing to open the coffers for the chosen candidates. That's why Steve Austria stepped out. He knew he wasn't one of the chosen candidates.
Right.
And therefore, he'd get beat up, and he probably knew he couldn't raise the money to counteract the internal Republican machine.
Right, and he was right. I think it's interesting, though, because there's a quote from one of the members of the House Government Oversight Committee, one of the Democrats, who said after this vote, he says, well, Chaffetz has pledged to take our committee in a different direction than his predecessor, focusing on real oversight and legislation, not partisan politics. Now, if you remember, this is the committee that handled Lois Lerner and the IRS investigation, Fast and Furious, and was looking into Benghazi. Okay. If those three things are just partisan politics and are not real oversight, I'm not sure what is.
Exactly. That is oversight.
It is oversight. But that's not what... See, but this Democrat's saying they're already assuming that because the Speaker has kind of pretty much gotten his person on the committee, that now we're going to get away from all of these things that are uncomfortable for the administration and move on to... Well, basically boring paper shuffling things.
Well, look who it is, though. The committee's ranking member is Elijah Cummings.
Yes. Well, and that may change too when they go when the Democrat right. caucus goes into creating well, their structures.
Ranking member is based on seniority, not necessarily
well,
on whether you're chosen to be a part of membership.
Right, right.
That's a that is a matter of he's been in Congress since oh, I don't know, 1910 or something.
Yes.
But he is an ultra radical. He's from Maryland. He is the kind of candidate that Marylanders love. He's ultra liberal. Not all Marylanders, obviously. They actually went red in the last election and elected, I think, a Republican governor throughout
O'Malley.
O'Malley. Walter,
O'Malley was the
Walter
Democrat.
O'Malley.
Yeah.
Who was actually considering using his governorship of Maryland as a platform to run for president. Oops. But nonetheless.
Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nonetheless. Elijah Cummings, probably the most partisan member, one of the most partisan members of the House of Representatives, is excoriating Daryl Issa, who, by the way, doesn't look like he got any other post. Why not?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what's going on. He may end up chairing a subcommittee, or he may end up on some special panel. Honestly, probably because he's reached his maximum he can for his retirement. I hate to say it that way, but that's usually what it is.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, it's like, okay, we can't give him any more money for anything, so just put him somewhere in the corner until he's ready to leave.
Well, people may not understand what that reference means. They just assume all congressmen get paid the same.
Oh, no, no. There are specific bumps for chairmanships of full committees, subcommittees, special panels. You know, folks, no good deed goes unrewarded, or no bad deed goes unrewarded. And so usually all of these assignments come with a stipend of some sort. Now, I know here in the state legislature, you know, they each make about $62,000 a year. But if you become a committee chairman, that's an extra $5,000 a year on top of your salary. So, you know, in a two-year cycle, that's $140,000 that you're making out of the taxpayers to basically run a committee once a week.
That's not a bad pay for a quote-unquote part-time position.
We are a full-time legislature, Charles. Now, you know that.
That means 3 days a week?
Well, there's that. It only meant 6 months out of the year. But
yeah.
That's, yeah. But anyhow, so that's maybe what's going on with that at the federal level. But you know what? Honestly, if Congress doesn't get serious in the 114th Congress about reining in the abuses of power from the administration, it won't matter who's the chairman of the committee.
No,
because
it won't.
Basically they will be neuter. They won't have any authority. Government oversight? Well, hey, you know, if we're going to consider real oversight partisan politics, and the only true oversight is just rubber stamping whatever the administration's doing, like executive ordering amnesty for 3 million illegal aliens in the country, folks, where's the oversight on that? I mean, first of all, I mean, Charles, you and I are both students of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sitting here with my little pocket version of the Constitution. And, you know, maybe this was an error print. It might be worth an awful lot of money as an error print. Because in here, I don't see any section that says anything about executive orders.
Well,
because the Constitution is actually silent to that. Except that the president is supposed to use, and this goes all the way back to Washington. George Washington started this. And it's basically a directive from the head of the executive branch to an executive branch agency on things they should and shouldn't be doing internally.
Basically, what the executive order is, it's one of those things that's called a concomitant power. Some people call it an implied power. There is no such thing as an implied power. It's a concomitant power.
Right, because the way our Constitution is written, that we have enumerated powers and we have enumerated limitations. There is no such thing as an implied power because the implication is if it wasn't given to you in writing, you don't have it.
Yeah, think about it this way. The Congress basically it has the power to set up post office and that kind of thing. Okay, you set up a post office. Does that not say also that you have to have, for instance, mailbags so that the mailmen can carry the post around and deliver it. That doesn't mean that you have to mention in the Constitution the fact that the post office has the right to buy mailbags. The fact is, that's one of the things that comes under the necessary and proper clause. That is a legitimate right. use of the necessary and proper clause of the...
Right, but writing an executive order to grant exactly. amnesty to 3 million illegal aliens is not part of the necessary, proper, or the general welfare clause, or the commerce clause, or any of the other elastic clauses of the Constitution.
Have you heard the latest defense of why he can do that?
No. Okay. Regale me with this constitutional falderal.
Well, I'm not going to mention the Constitution because it's not in there.
Exactly.
And they're not making that particular case. What I'm going to tell you is they're saying we can do it because Ronald Reagan did it. And
precedent.
Yes,
precedent.
Okay. The fact is, my reply to the person that brought that up was, okay, so Ronald Reagan violated the law, and that means Obama can?
Well, but see, Chuck, and I think you're bringing up a really good point that we need to remind our listeners. Be careful whose ox is getting gored.
Yes.
Because ultimately it will be yours. Sometimes we have a tendency as conservatives to believe that whatever our guys are doing is great and good, even if it's extra constitutional or possibly... shaded somewhat questionably legal because it's advancing the cause. But then when it gets turned around and the other side uses the exact same framing to advance their pet projects, all of a sudden we become hardliners on the Constitution.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, and see, the problem is that's called hypocrisy. And the fact is, we get what we deserve, and if we ignore it from our guys, then it sounds hollow for us to complain about it from the other guys. You and I oftentimes get chided and our chops busted because we're not good team players.
Yes.
and we've heard that phrase used against us. You guys are just not team players. Whose team are you on?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not on the R party team or the D party team. I'm on the team of we the people of the U.S. Constitution and the team that says we have a constitutional representative republic, not a ten-horn dictatorship or a pure democracy where might makes right. That's not our form of government. That's never been our form of government. But if we sit here and what happens is, as we say, you get Congress, who gets elected time and time again. Most of the time, the incumbents come right back, and they get this sense of entitlement that they can do whatever they feel like because, well, you've got no place else to go if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You know, both parties play that against their bases. Well, where else are you going to go? If you go to them, then, you know, life as we know it ends. And then they end up, when it's time for them to actually do something that may be difficult, i.e. like impeachment or like stopping a president by using their veto overrides, all of a sudden we got to work together. We have time that we have to spend here and we'll get our way later. And it's just foolish.
Basically, you know, you're right. And this is that argument that the executive has all this power. And the fact is that essentially he has to be caught with a smoking gun in his hand, having robbed a liquor store to get impeached.
Yes.
Well, that's not what impeachment was for, ever. Here's what we lead people through when we talk about this in our class. Essentially, what's the highest law of the land?
Right.
Well, according to Article 6, the highest law of the land is the Constitution.
Right.
Okay. So, when a president violates the United States Constitution, has he not committed a high crime or misdemeanor?
Well, yes, either way you look at it.
And the fact is that presidents who sign things like amnesty executive orders, and we're waiting for a big one. This, again, we're recording on Wednesday. I think tomorrow's supposed to be a big announcement about this executive action that's basically going to legalize something like, you know, umpteen million people who are already here. That's a violation of the highest law of the land.
Yes, it is.
Which is a high crime or misdemeanor. And we have the right to expect that Congress will step in. Now, when you see John Boehner saying stupid things, like he said a few days ago, that I begged the president to allow us to pass amnesty, to pass some kind of an immigration bill before he acted, but he said no. Folks, read the Constitution. Article 1, it says flat out that Congress is the place where legislation gets passed to regulate immigration and naturalization. It's one of the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. Yes. Period.
Yes.
And the fact that the president's going to step in, now what's he going to do? He's going to say, use existing law to do this, that, or another thing. You can't do it that way. And that's what we were talking about with executive orders. You can only use an executive order to cause one of your executive department heads to do his job. It's part of the mandate in Article 2 that the president shall take care that all the laws be executed faithfully. That's what the executive order is for. It's to make sure that the department heads are faithfully executing the law that is under their jurisdiction.
Oh, sort of like Eric Holder and Fast and Furious?
Oh, you mean where you violate your own gun regulations in order? And not only that, the sovereign nation of Mexico.
Yes.
The fact is that we allowed guns to be shipped illegally into Mexico.
Oh, don't worry. We're getting them back.
Yeah.
in the hands of MS-13 and other gangs that are coming across.
And that's exactly where they're coming from. We're getting them back when they're confiscated after crimes being committed with them. The whole thing is just a mess. And, you know, what do you do about that? The answer is you impeach.
Right. Well, the point is that, and we understand that politics is a balancing act. And yes, the Congress has got a number of things that they're looking at trying to do that they might, it would probably be easier for them if they can get the president just to sign off on them. But when the key comes right down to it, congressmen, U.S. senators, are representatives of the people. We give you your job by electing you to office. We pay your salary and your benefits and everything else through our tax dollars. And the least we could expect is that you follow the operation manual of the company that you're in, which is the United States Congress, and that employee handbook is the United States Constitution, wherein it specifically spells out the things that our legislators are expected to do and expected to not do. Now, it isn't just in Article 1, Chuck, because we know that in Article 2, they have impeachment powers. In Article 3, they have the ability to set up and concomitantly take down federal courts and to impeach justices of those courts for doing something wrong and to limit the ability of the courts to hear certain cases.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because if you don't understand how the Constitution works, all this sounds like gobbledygook.
Yes.
Well, and here's another problem you run into. Remember, folks, the Constitution was written for average people. Now, granted, average people of the time who were basically, unfortunately, I'm sad to say, more literate than we are. Nonetheless, this was not a legalese document. It was designed for people of average intelligence to be able to read and understand.
Yes,
yes, there are some changes in language. No big deal. That's why you get yourself a nice 1828 dictionary. We live in the age of the internet. It's free online. You look up the words. Okay. That being said, we have people who are hiding behind college degrees and professorships and quote-unquote scholarship to say things that are unbelievably silly about what the Constitution actually says. Now, when you ask, when you get into these things where these people are explaining this thing and hiding behind their expertise to tell you things that are just simply not true about the Constitution, they're relying on the fact that they have a status as a quote-unquote scholar or an expert, and you won't check their footnotes. Let me tell you something. Check their footnotes. We have, Barry and I have discovered so much essentially fraud by looking at those footnotes and double checking and seeing where they go and reading the articles and reading the books and reading. You say you don't have enough time. You got plenty of time.
Charles, you just now used the word reading four or five times. I think you scared off about two-thirds of the people.
I know.
But the key is, folks, we cannot understand these things unless we read them and we determine what it is that they're saying and not saying. Don't just trust, don't trust Chuck and I. Don't trust anybody who puts himself up as an expert taking somebody else's work and telling you what it says. Look for yourself. I mean, I think about it, you know, we kind of use this as a joke, but, you know, an old friend of ours, Gary DeMara, said, you know, if you take things out of context, you can make any written text say anything you want it to say, including the Bible, you know, and you, Chuck, you like that, you know.
Yeah, oh, I love that quote. Gary DeMara used this, Judas hanged himself, go and do likewise, and what you do, do quickly, because there is no God.
Exactly. So, but the point is, those are all taken out of context from that work. But that's the problem. Unless we read in context and we see what's going on, and go back. Folks, that's the beautiful part about scholarly works. Usually they're footnoted, and those footnotes take you to other works. It's really not that difficult now at the age of the internet, because most of them are hyperlinked. So you can go and click on a couple of clicks and go right to an article or a book or anything else, and see what the author's intent and philosophical presupposition actually was when writing the work. Now, Chuck, we do this with the Constitution, because the problem is, if you take it on the advice of many of our quote-unquote constitutional law experts today out there, like Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University and other people, the Constitution is this constantly evolving, living document that's morphing, and the organism is growing sort of like a cancer, and it's taking on new shapes and new forms to fit its circumstances, like it's the grand chameleon of government. However, if you read the document, which is what that's the reason why we teach Institute on the Constitution classes, is to get people to actually read this document. It's not that hard, ladies and gentlemen. And we look at it from the context and from the definitions that were extant during the time period in which the Constitution was actually penned. Because we use the Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the English Language, which are the definitions that our founders understood to be the common definitions of the words they used in this document of government called the Constitution. You know, if you've got I know some editions, when they print it, they don't bother with this because they don't get it or they don't want to get it. But if you get a really good edition, like one Cato Institute puts out or some other groups put out, what you're going to find are a bunch of capitalized words all throughout the document in weird places, and those words are not all proper names or nouns or things of that nature, or the subjects of sentences. You know, but what it is, that was the way they punctuated back then to let you know that these words had specific fixed meanings that would not change. They use capitalization to say this word's important, folks. Pay attention to it.
Not only that, grammatical rules count.
Yes, they do.
A lot. And we ran into this the other night in our class. We had someone who was quoting to us from the Second Amendment. And guess what? His copy left out commas.
Left out the punctuation marks.
Yeah. When you leave out the commas, the dependent clauses suddenly disappear.
That's right. And when that happens, then you've got a big, big, big problem.
Then it doesn't say what it says. It says something entirely different. So we had to actually say, nope, put that one away and look in the one that's properly punctuated that we gave you. And they did, and they said, oh, you're right, there's all these commas. And I said, there are copies out there. People who are trying to change the meaning of the Second Amendment by removing the commas.
Yes.
It's that simple.
Yep, it is. Sadly enough, it is. But that's the key, folks. Reading these things for yourself are key. Now, many of our Congress people have not read or studied the Constitution themselves to actually know what it is they can and can't do or what they should and shouldn't be doing when they're representing you.
Well, okay. Let's take an example of someone who actually attempted to try to follow it.
Sure.
And some people, the hair will go up on the back of some people's necks. It was Ron Paul.
Right.
And the fact is that there are people who call themselves conservative who excoriate Paul because he attempted to get the government to stick to the text and the original meaning of the Constitution. That's what it was all about, folks. When Ron Paul came out and did things that you didn't like, it was because he was following the text, the letter of the law of the U.S. Constitution.
And oftentimes when we've slipped away from following the Constitution and we've done it because of whatever exigency might be out there or whatever, convenience it might be to say, well, we just don't have to follow that right now because we really have to get this important thing done. And then we create that precedent that we talked about earlier. You know, well, Reagan did this with executive orders, so why can't Barack Obama? So again, folks, we got to be careful whose ox is being gored here.
Yes.
Because once you slip away from the standard of it is written, you can go off into some really weird places. Now, if you think about it, folks, we talk about this in our class, too. Although the Constitution itself is not wholly writ, we have to use the standard, the same standard that Christ used when he faced Satan in the wilderness. Whenever Satan would throw something out at him, well, you know, why don't you just do this, this, and this? Jesus didn't come back with him, well, my opinion is this, this, and this. He said,
yeah, that's right.
He said, it is written. It is written. He went back to the inscripturated word. He went back to an authoritative, documented source for his reply. Our big problem today, Chuck, is the vast majority of people out there, whether it be on the blogosphere, Facebook, calling in to the radio, conservative talk shows, or actually contacting their members of Congress, the vast majority of the time what they're saying is, I feel, I think, I hope, I believe, it's my opinion, all of which means, well, you're one of 319 plus million people out there who have an opinion, including the person you're talking to, and since they hold a gavel or they have an elected office and they're getting paid to do it, their opinion means more than yours to them.
That's right.
So, but if you come back with a documented authoritative standard, such as the United States Constitution, say, you know what, Congressman Boehner, in Article 1, Section 8 of this document, there is no authority for you to support or uphold Obamacare because health care is not an allowable area of congressional legislative involvement. It's not in there. Okay, one of three things are going to happen. Number one, he's going to ignore you completely and silence. And that means that he's opening the door for you to keep saying, well, you must agree with me and you agree with that you are not following the Constitution. Okay, then he'll have to respond one way or the other to that. Second thing is he responds back to you and say, well, you know, because of this, this, and this, this is more important. No. You took an oath to uphold and defend this Constitution, and that means to follow it. So you're telling me now that you're violating your oath? This situation allows you to violate your oath? And then there's the third, is that he gets back and says, well, you know, that doesn't mean what you think it means, and I think it means this. Well, then you can educate him on what the Constitution actually says and does and why the congressman or the elected official in question should be paying closer attention to the capitalized words in this document.
Exactly. Exactly. Barry, we've reached a place in our discourse. I had this happen to me at least twice in discussions on issues. Someone will post an article which supposedly refutes what I've said. One of the things I ran into was the birth question, the natural-born citizen question. And someone will post an article written by a quote-unquote expert. And I'll show them in the Constitution what it says, and I'll say, and here's the source for where they got it, and I point directly to that source. The natural-born citizen clause comes from Emmerich de Vittel. I can even tell you it's Book 1, Chapter 19, Section 212. In case you're interested in and want to find out what that's about. And the fact is, well, this expert says this. And I'm like, but I showed you in the Constitution. You do the same. I don't care what the expert says. If the expert is basically using his expertise to hide the fact that he's making it up as he goes along, I could care less. I can write you 600 or 800 words on a subject, completely obfuscate the original meaning of the article I'm reviewing if I want to do that. But it's dishonest and disingenuous to do that. Okay, you showed me from an article. Now show me from the Constitution like I did you. And you know what I get after that? Blah, 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 blah. I'll get like... But you can't do that. He does this. He's a professor. Yeah, he's a professor of such and such and so and so, and he works for the Cato Institute. Again, I don't care where he works. Show me in the Constitution.
Right. Exactly.
And if you keep going back to the well, I don't want to put too religious a connotation on it, but I believe there's a phrase ad fontes.
Yes.
Back to the fountain.
Back to the fountain.
You have to go ad fontes back to the Constitution.
Right, exactly.
Which is not, again, this is not a divine document, but it is the highest law of the land.
It is.
And you have to go there. You have to. And you have to get people to think in those terms, because I also ran into this problem with an Article 5 convention. Again, well, this expert says that... certain states made a call that allowed, gave them plenipotentiary powers, but the rest of them didn't, blah, blah, blah. And I go, okay, here is a document that has all 13 states' resolutions, and I will quote to you from the state that you mentioned. Doesn't matter. Oh, well, you've taken it out of context. I go, you can't take this out of context. This is the context. Here it is. Here's what it says. But this expert who has, you know, in court cases and blah, blah, show me in the document. Ad fontes. Show me in the document. And once you do that, they're lost. It doesn't matter what your expert says.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Well, Chuck, we're going to be starting this. If listeners want to go, we're going to start a series on our website on principlepolicy.com. where we're going to be doing a book review. Now, that book review is not of a current book. It's of a book that's out of print. But it's a book that's so important to the topics that we've been talking about and is being used by others. Not ad fontes, I'll grant you that.
No, definitely not.
That we decided that it was time, it was past time, for us to do a public service and go through and reread this book and go through all the chapters and chapter by chapter do a book review for you. And hopefully to spur some things to help enlighten our reading audience as to what they should be looking for when they're being told by others what the Constitution supposedly says versus what it actually does say in certain instances. And this book, again, it's about, let's see, there's 7, 8, 9, 10, there's 9 chapters plus a 10th, you know, for the preface and things. And we're going to do this in a series. Chuck and I are going to go back and forth on it. We've done this before with books where each of us will take a chapter and we'll break it down and we'll write and we'll kick it to the other person. We'll take a look at it, play around, offer suggestions to each other, and then post it up for you. But it's a book called Constitutional Brinksmanship. And that title's important, but we're not going to tell you why right now. We'll let you read that. But it's we're dealing with it right now in this country, and we're seeing it daily. When we talk about this whole showdown between Congress and the administration over amnesty, when we see this breakdown between the House and the Senate over various issues like Keystone Pipeline, which the House passed, the Senate wouldn't pass it. You know, basically, these are all levels of brinksmanship. But when you get up to the constitutional level and you start playing with issues that would have a long-term impact on the Constitution or on our form of government, that's when we ought to set up and take notice and be careful about what we're reading. So we're going to be doing this, so keep watching. I think our first post is going to go up this week.
Well, the introduction will
go up real quick, and then as we figure out who's going to take which portions of this, we will have quite a field day with this, and your comments and insights on this on our webpage would be helpful. We'd appreciate that too.
Let's give them we got to give them the web address.
Okay.
principledpolicy.com, www.principledpolicy.com. That's so you know where to go. If you're listening to this on a podcast, you're pretty much there. You know, iTunes has a link out to the site. Click on that. If you're listening to it on the site, you're already there. Look for the article.
Yep, exactly. Now, Chuck, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, and there was one thing we were going to talk. I thought I want to hold off our in-depth analysis of a certain politician till next week.
Yeah, okay.
But what I want to do is I want to kind of set the tone for that with this. During this last election and during all these leadership votes at the federal and the state levels, the word conservative keeps getting thrown around. And, you know, the more you use something, the more you wear it out. Well, what they've tried to do in order to make it fresh again is to put adjectives in front of it. You know, new and improved. You ever see that, you know, where a detergent company, you know, they know that they've, like, reached their maximum users, people who are buying their detergent. So all of a sudden they come out with new and improved. And it's the same stuff, mind you. Maybe they just changed the color of it or something. But that's to get more people to buy it. Well, that's what happens with politicians with the word conservatism. Conservatism, it started to get the brand was starting to wear out for people because it didn't allow them to be, well, let's just be honest, progressive. You know, and so we started with having adjectives added to the word conservatism. And if you remember what the first one was, compassionate conservatism.
Yes, compassionate conservatism.
A la former President George Bush. What did compassionate conservatism mean? It meant that we were going to go off the traditional conservative reservation on certain issues, mostly social issues. Okay? Then we rolled into, well, when compassionate conservatism, kind of the brand started getting a little
tainted.
Well, I was going to say frayed around the edges like an old rug. Then we came up with common sense conservatism. And candidates like Rob Portman started using that on all of their mailings. Well, what does common sense conservative mean? It just means I'm conservative until I have to take a vote, and then I vote with the establishment because that's common sense. It's just a vote where to not bite the hand that feeds you, in other words.
Yeah, well, common sense is that you don't vote to do something to Medicare, Social Security, Name a giveaway program, student loans.
You name an entitlement program that has a powerful lobby, and that's what we're talking
Bingo.
About. Okay. Well, then you had, because even common sense conservatism was starting to get a little faded, then we had pragmatic conservatism.
Pragmatic, yeah.
And that was the choice word, self-described word, that the new or incoming Speaker of the House of Representatives in Ohio, Cliff Rosenberger, used to basically encapsulate his brand of conservatism. He's a pragmatic conservative. Now, many observers think pragmatic just means doing whatever the governor wants you to do, and that's being that's your pragmatic conservatism. and we even heard Governor Kasich, and that's who we're going to be talking about next week, folks, but Governor Kasich saying that he had the right to define what conservatism is. Although his definition of conservatism has already been defined, Chuck. And that's what I want to go to, because during all of these adjectival emoluments and fluffy add-ons that we put onto the word conservative, what we've forgotten about is, what's the definition of conservative? What does conservatism really mean? Well, you know what, folks? That question has been asked for over 150 years. And I think the definition that I think is most accurate, and it may not be, people may be, shall we say, uncomfortable with this, but I think it's very spot on, came from a historical figure by the name of Robert Louis Dabney. Now, Dabney was a Southern theologian, and he was aide-de-camp to General Stonewall Jackson during the War for Southern Independence, or the Civil War, whatever you want to call it, War of Northern Aggression, whatever you want to call it. But Dabney wrote in one of his writings this whole idea about conservatism. And he says in part about conservatism, this is a party which never conserves anything. And he's right. Conservatism sees itself as a separate party, almost. Its history has been that it demurs to each aggression of the Progressive Party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but always acquiesces at last in the innovation. In other words, they will put up a nice front, but when push comes to shove, they will just go along to get along. He keeps going. He says, what was the resisted novelty of yesterday is today one of the accepted principles of conservatism. It is now conservative only in affecting to resist the next innovation, which will tomorrow be forced upon its timidity and will be succeeded by some third revolution to be denounced and then adopted in its turn. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward toward perdition. It remains behind it, but never retards it, and always advances near its leader. Its impotency is not hard indeed to explain. It is worthless because it is the conservatism of expediency only and not of sturdy principle. It intends to risk nothing serious for the sake of the truth and has no idea of being guilty of the folly of martyrdom. It always, when about to enter a protest, very blandly informs the wild beast whose path it essays to stop that its, quote, bark is worse than its bite, unquote, and that it only means to save its manners by enacting its decent role of resistance. The only practical purpose which it now serves in American politics is to give enough exercise to radicalism to keep it in wind and to prevent its becoming pursy and lazy from having nothing to whip. No doubt after a few years, conservatism will tacitly admit it into its creed. That's whatever progressive thing is coming on next.
Sure.
And thenceforthward plume itself upon its wise firmness in opposing with similar weapons the extreme of the next innovation. And when that too shall have been won, it will be heard declaring that the integrity of the American Constitution requires at least the refusal of the next innovation.
Well, I think that's a great observation, because all you have to do, you don't have to go very far to see people who call themselves conservative, and what are they defending? They're defending the New Deal.
Yes.
Yeah, let's go back to the halcyon days of 1935, you know, with all this great program that FDR came up with to end the Depression. And boy, didn't it bring the Depression to an end. Well, no, it didn't. The Depression started really, everybody starts it at 1929, really didn't start till about 1931. And it lasted right up till the beginning of the war. And the reason that it stopped at the war was because all of a sudden everybody was buying American munitions. And those who weren't working in munitions plants got drafted into the Army. Well, folks, that's artificial recovery. So really the effects of the Depression, some people say, lasted up until really about 1952. So 20 years, that's not a very good track record. But I love that description. I've heard that from Dabney before. I love that description, and it is so apt. And folks, I would say keep that in mind, because next week we're going to be talking about someone who calls himself a conservative who is not. And we've already announced that's John Kasich, among other people. Mm-hmm. And we are out of time for this week. Please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.